From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Newsweek story was just a few hundred words. One sentence set off the firestorm. It asserted that a coming military report would say that interrogators at Guantanamo Bay, in an attempt to rattle detainees, had flushed a Koran down a toilet. The news was blamed for inciting riots in the Muslim world, where at least 17 people were killed. Islamic leaders called it an unforgivable crime, an attack on Islam's sacred text. Yesterday, Newsweek fully retracted the story. But the bigger story won't die. Of journalistic woes and of Muslims after Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and Koran headlines, so ready to believe the worst of the United States. Tonight on Point, the Newsweek debacle and America's big, troubled conversation with the Muslim world. We begin tonight in Washington with Mark Mazzetti, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him what the Pentagon response has been to Newsweek's retraction of its story of Koran flushing at Guantanamo Bay.
Well, the Pentagon has said that Newsweek did the right thing by retracting the story. The Pentagon has used very angry language over the last few days about the report. Larry Derrida, the Pentagon spokesman, said today that he believed it led to people's deaths over in Central Asia. So the fact that Newsweek retracted the report, the Pentagon says, is a good step.
Now, the initial Newsweek report said that a coming military report would itself say that interrogators had flushed the Koran down the toilet to unnerve detainees. Is the Pentagon saying that's wrong, that there's no such reference in any report that they're bringing out?
That's right, and it's important to point out they are denying the substance of the Newsweek report, which was that a military investigation, which is an investigation led by Lieutenant General Schmidt down at Southern Command, had found evidence of desecration of the Koran. They're saying that this investigation has found no such evidence. And so they are not saying that this has never happened at any point at Guantanamo Bay, but they are saying that a military investigation has found no evidence that this occurred. There have been incidences, military officials say, where detainees themselves ripped pages out of the Koran as a protest, but they have said that the interrogators or any U.S. military personnel never, as far as they know, in any way purposely desecrated the Koran.
So it's a broad denial of any deliberate desecration. But you know, Mark, as anyone reading around does, there have been these repeated claims over time that this has happened from inmates at Guantanamo, from interrogators or translators at Guantanamo, even reports that there were hunger strikes after instances of desecration of the Koran. How is the Pentagon's denial being received?
Well, we pressed spokesman Larry Derrida today about, well, whether they'd in fact investigated. The allegations have been out there. Have they investigated them? And he said that they have not investigated the claims because they were found not to be credible. So as far as we could tell after a lot of back and forth at the briefing today was that the Pentagon has not found any evidence of such desecration. They have not, though, thoroughly looked into these allegations made by the former detainees, or at least the lawyers of the former detainees.
They've simply decided or determined that the allegations themselves were not credible, using their word.
That's correct, and they found no basis to investigate them, I guess is the way to characterize the Pentagon's position.
Mark, within the U.S. military, I mean, you've been reporting there for a while. Do you sense an attitude, if not at the Pentagon level, that in the field, that might lead to this kind of perceived abuse of the Koran? Do you perceive a kind of anger toward symbols of Islam?
I don't sense that in the military as a whole. I don't sense that when you're with troops, even at the lowest level, that they feel this base anger toward Islam. And certainly, they have been instructed by their superiors that any kind of an act like a desecration of the Koran would be punishable and it'd be totally counterproductive to their efforts in the Middle East or in Central Asia. Now, the other question is about whether these are used in interrogations. And as we know, over the past year, there have been a lot of things that have gone on during interrogations that were not approved. And whether some interrogator might have seen this as a potentially effective interrogation technique, who knows? But I would say broadly, the military, even if the soldiers think this is not something that they would have done on a daily basis.
But as you say, from Abu Ghraib to Guantanamo, there have been repeated instances of religiously tinged approaches to prisoners. I mean, whether it's having them in naked piles or female interrogators in skimpy clothing or even making inmates believe they had menstrual blood smeared on their face, it would appear from the outside there's a kind of coming right up to the line here at the very least.
Yes, and if you look specifically at Guantanamo Bay, there is an investigation going on into these allegations of abuse. There's an investigation into the things you discussed that were raised in emails by FBI agents who are down at Guantanamo Bay, and that's the Schmidt investigation, which we would expect out in a couple of weeks, and we'll see what actual instances of abuse they've come up with. The Pentagon did point out that in early 2003, they put in place a very strict standard operating procedure in dealing with the Quran, and in terms of how U.S. military personnel handled the Quran, the way that they searched cells at Gitmo, if they came across the Quran, how they would handle it. And so they say that since then, there's been very rigid procedures in place. That does bring up the question about the year before that, which was, you know, a whole year after 9/11, before these guidelines were in place, though.
Mark, finally, and this is perhaps a difficult question talking about fellow journalists, but what's your interpretation of what happened with and to Newsweek here?
That is tough. You know, I think that Newsweek certainly didn't expect that their item would have had the impact that it has had over the last week. I think that's very fair to say, especially because, again, as you say, these allegations had been out there in the past. We're all wrestling right now with the use of anonymous sources and possibly the abuse of anonymous sources and the amount, especially in Washington, that they get used. So, you know, I think that this example, from the media perspective, has sort of been a window into how the sausage is made in Washington in terms of how people report their stories and the extent and the thoroughness with which they report their stories.
And I guess I have to ask one more thing. We read last week that General Myers was saying that the protests in Afghanistan were not tied to the article in Newsweek. Now the White House is saying practically Newsweek has blood on its hands.
Yes, last week during a Pentagon briefing, General Myers said that the commanders on the ground in Afghanistan specifically did not think that the protests in that country were specifically tied to the Newsweek article. Now, they did not sort of broaden that to say that the no protests throughout the region, whether they're in Pakistan or anywhere else, were not linked to the Newsweek article.
I'm sorry, but Afghanistan is where the deaths were.
That's correct. And so in terms of the protests and the deaths, General Myers did say that according to U.S. commanders on the ground, they didn't think that there was a specific link.
But now the White House saying people have died. Of course, they have died. I guess exactly why may be still an issue. Mark Mazzetti, thanks very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Mazzetti is Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about the Newsweek debacle, about Muslim outrage and news media fallout. You can join the conversation. Does Newsweek magazine have blood on its hands? Or is the White House in part responsible for creating a climate where this story was so easily believed in the Muslim world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Marco Island, Florida, is John Esposito, university professor and professor of religion and international affairs and Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He's author of What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam. John Esposito, thank you for being with us tonight.
Delighted to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here this evening.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Esposito.
John Esposito, there's a lot to talk about here, but just give us your top of mind. How do you respond to this? You spent a lot of time looking at the West's relations with the Islamic world. Now this, what do you make of it?
Well, I think a number of things. I think, number one, I think for a lot of people, it's very important for them to try to appreciate what this act or action really means.
The alleged action now denied.
Yeah, but it's important to understand. Many people say, but why do people react so strongly? I mean, the fact is, for believing Muslims, the Quran is the sacred. The Quran is the Word of God.
Is it the equivalent of the Bible in those terms?
No, it's more than that.
Why? How?
As one person has said, by comparison, the Quran's position within Islam is similar to the position of Jesus within Christianity.
The actual embodiment of the divine.
That's right. The Quran is where you engage the transcendent God in this life. It's that sacred. So it's not simply like, as bad as it is, doing something to a Muslim or a Muslim believer or to a sort of another holy book. I mean, this is a sacrilegious action.
But it's like doing something to God himself.
Exactly. But more importantly, or equally important, this response occurs within the context of what's been going on for quite some time, certainly post 9/11. And that is, in many ways, a belief among many Muslims in the Muslim world that the war against global terrorism is not just against global terrorism, but that in fact it is an attempt to redraw the map of the Muslim world by the United States. And it occurs within a context of Abu Ghraib, of Guantanamo, and of some similar accusations that have occurred before, and accusations made by some detainees who've left. So you have a very complex mix here. And one could argue that what has exacerbated what would have been, let's say, narrowly speaking, a religious issue and made it very political is, in fact, the climate, regrettably, created by some of the Bush policies. And it raises, I think, substantial questions about also Newsweek's responsibility, not only with regard to the story, but the fallout in terms of, let's say, American reporters.
No kidding. Jack Beatty, there's a lot of background here. We'll talk more about it. But on the other hand, what we're told now is that it didn't happen, or at least Newsweek won't stand by its story. It's the unevent.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's a shadow of meaning that won't carry in the Muslim world, where, according to that Zoghbi poll of last year, 98% of Egyptians, 89% of Saudis, 78% of Jordanians, 88% of Moroccans have an unfavorable view of the United States.
So there's Newsweek sitting with a whole lot of trouble on its hands, but the United States with maybe even bigger trouble. We're talking tonight about the Newsweek disaster, the Quran debacle, and America's big, troubled conversation with the Muslim world. John Esposito is with us from Georgetown University. Jack Beatty, you can join us as well. What do you think? Who should be singing Mea Culpa tonight? Newsweek for bad reporting? The White House for apparently having the world primed to believe it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Newsweek disaster, the Quran debacle, and America's big, troubled conversation with the Muslim world. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the good the U.S. is trying to do in Iraq and Afghanistan being outweighed by Abu Ghraib, by the stories from Guantanamo, by the headlines, retracted or not, later, about the Quran? And should, how are you interpreting the Newsweek calamity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by John Esposito. He is professor of international affairs and Islamic studies at Georgetown University. We're joined now from Palo Alto, California, by James Bettinger. He's director of the John S. Knight Fellowships for Journalists at Stanford University. James Bettinger, thanks for being with us tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
So, wade in to the Newsweek's mea culpa, its role, what went wrong here. What's your bottom line on what's transpired? I mean, it just looks like a horrible mess. Is this all Newsweek's fault?
Well, all Newsweek's fault is a little large, but clearly the article in a little Periscope item in Newsweek did trigger something. As to what went wrong, I think that it shows one of the dangers of using anonymous sources, and the danger in this particular case is that the anonymous source was a couple of times removed from whatever the actual fact was. That is, he had seen a report, thought it was a particular report that was about to be forthcoming. Turns out that he did not.
And now the White House and the Pentagon today are essentially saying Newsweek has blood on its hands. Is that fair?
I don't know if that's fair or not. One of the things I have noticed is that the White House and the Pentagon have been able to shift the discussion of the interrogation abuse from whether or not it happened to the quality of news reporting, which works to its advantage in keeping the attention elsewhere.
So, and what do you make of the backdrop here? I mean, was Newsweek too willing to believe this secondhand anticipating source because of the other events that have been formally, you know, recorded?
Yeah, I see what you're... clearly, it was too willing to believe its source in this particular case because it's now had to back down. What's hard to figure is whether it should have been more cautious given what it already knew. This was a very experienced reporter dealing with a source who had proven reliable in the past.
Michael Isikoff, the reporter who's been on this show many times.
And has a reputation within the magazine of an extremely cautious reporter. As one person told me, he's the last person to kind of pull the trigger on something, so he always wants to make sure it's right. So given all those kinds of things, we say, well, this is a reliable source, it's a reliable reporter, it must be all right. But again, it is a single source, and it's a single source in a very small incremental development. That is, this is not the first time that allegations that the Quran had been either placed on a toilet or flushed in the toilet had been made, but in the past they had always been from detainees. This was a report from a government, it was supposedly in a government report and was therefore given more credibility. That's the incremental development that persuaded Newsweek to go ahead with this item.
James Bettinger, you know the kind of scuttlebutt that's going around, the kind of counter line in some journalistic circles saying, well, Newsweek has been set up here. It's a kind of gotcha game. Here's CBS and Dan Rather Redux. There's a lot of anger at Newsweek and a lot of bafflement at how they could print something that sent off so much death and anger. But there's also this kind of conspiracy theme out there.
I've heard that too, and I have to admit I tend to discount it. I mean, it bespeaks a level of sort of complexity and competence that I think would be hard to pull off. I take Newsweek at its word, and I think it's true that the Pentagon would have to bear some, whoever the Pentagon officials who saw this story in advance, that neither realized the degree to which this particular little item would set off the kind of violence it has. That is, as you know, Newsweek says that it realized that this was a sensitive issue, so it showed the item to two Pentagon sources who were not involved, who were not the original source of the story, and they didn't say, "Oh, this is dynamite stuff," or "Don't print it," or any of those kinds of things.
Excuse me, can I say something?
Yes, John Esposito, please.
I always like to say that my dad used to say to his three sons, who were first generation to go to university but got very good education, "You're too bright to be that stupid." And when a Newsweek representative makes a statement, as was reported in the press today, a senior Newsweek person, "We didn't realize how explosive this was." Gee, does anybody remember the Rushdie affair and what happened after that? To me, it boggles the mind that given what happened with Rushdie, but more importantly, given what was just said earlier about the degree of anti-Americanism, the extent to which there are reported incidents, not only by detainees, alleged incidents, but you've got what went on in Abu Ghraib. You have a new book out this week, Inside the Wire, by someone who was a sergeant in the military.
Eric Saar.
Right. In light of all of that, it's kind of difficult to believe that both Newsweek and these Pentagon representatives didn't realize what was going to happen. And if that's the case, it raises profound questions about the way in which foreign policy continues to be made and the way in which some in the media don't understand the very areas that they're reporting on.
Jack Beatty, this is quite an incredible picture of the Muslim world becoming more and more sensitive as what we're kind of hearing here, potentially, the United States, including the media, becoming desensitized, as if a throwaway line about a Quran in a toilet could be in a sort of cute upfront section of the magazine, and on we'd go.
Yes, and the administration really is trying to make three efforts to change this: liberation, democracy, and public diplomacy. But when you look at we've liberated Iraq, but when you look at the report of the Defense Science Board from last December, an extremely candid report, they say, as to liberation, they found no yearning to be liberated by the U.S. groundswell among Muslim societies. As for democracy, quote, "When Americans talk about bringing democracies to Islamic societies, they see it as no more than self-serving hypocrisy." And as to public diplomacy, the president has now appointed Karen Hughes, his former close advisor, to essentially conduct a public diplomacy campaign. Well, here's what the report says about that. U.S. public diplomacy is in crisis, missing strong leadership, strategic direction, adequate coordination, sufficient resources, and a culture of measurement and evaluation. And it points out, we spend $1.2 billion, or did last year, on public diplomacy, on trying to deal with these huge problems our conduct has created, the friction has created, and that is 0.25% of the Pentagon budget. So, yes, the administration says, well, these problems can be taken care of by liberating these societies, by bringing democracy, and by public diplomacy, and the Defense Science Advisory Board says none of these things seem to be cutting in the Muslim world.
Throw a Koran down the toilet headline on top of all that, and you've got a real bonfire. I want to welcome to our conversation from Washington, Paul Marshall. He's a senior fellow at Freedom House's Center for Religious Freedom, editor of Radical Islam's Rules, the worldwide spread of extreme Sharia law. Freedom House is America's oldest human rights group, founded by Eleanor Roosevelt in 1941. Paul Marshall, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Here's Newsweek with a big, fat retraction, all kinds of anger all around the world. James Bettinger says, yeah, we've got problems here. How big the problem?
I think it's a very big problem. In terms of its effect on opinion in the Muslim world, I think it will have a worse effect than Abu Ghraib.
Worse, because it's the Quran.
Yeah, it's a much more sensitive issue. There may be sort of outrage at what is done to prisoners, but people are aware of that. But something which touches a religious nerve like this goes far deeper.
But why is it Newsweek taking all the heat here? I mean, if it's a mistake, it's a big mistake, and it's had big consequences. But isn't the back... I mean, we've all seen the images out of Abu Ghraib. You know those have been seen by a billion Muslims. The reports out of Guantanamo just go on and on now, year after year. And yet it's Newsweek that's getting all the heat.
Well, two things. One, it deserves a lot of heat. The story originally ran, as we said in the Periscope section, not a full news story, and so in that sense it was treated lightly. It turned out their sourcing wasn't that good, and for a story this explosive, I think John Esposito said earlier, what sort of world are you living in that you did not know the effect of such a story? So I think this, any news story should be treated seriously and double-checked. But this one, most of all, they should have done that. So they deserve heat. At the same time, you have to say, it's not Newsweek that's killing people. When there are riots in Afghanistan and people who are killed, that is the responsibility of the rioters. You can't turn around and say, you made me angry, so it's okay for me to kill people. We need to look at the culprits who actually engage in violence and not excuse them. At the same time, Newsweek was clueless in not being aware that this might happen.
Mm. Paul Marshall at the Freedom House, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
I want to take a call here. Stephen is calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I want to state that it's certainly shameful if they desecrated a Quran. I think really the big story here is that... how does the Muslim leadership seem to ignore what comes out of its own world when burning a flag, an American flag, is like a cliche in the Muslim world? And
beheading on video, not uncommon?
Yeah, burning George Bush in effigy, blowing up Buddha statues, absolutely rabid anti-Semitism that comes out of the mosques every Friday night. And yet somehow we're supposed to be so apologetic that, God forbid, we might have done something to insult them. I mean, I think that it's time to lean on some of the leadership of the so-called moderate Muslims and say, look, look what's coming out of your world, and that shouldn't you be as apologetic as you're expecting us to be.
Stephen, hang on with that. John Esposito, we don't forget for a moment what you've reminded us tonight, that the Quran is seen literally as the divine itself. But what about Stephen's larger point?
Well, I think that it's a very good point, and it's a set of issues to be raised, but I think to raise it in this context simply ducks the issue. It sounds like with one hand one says, certainly it's wrong to desecrate, but let me now dump. The reality of it is, you commit this kind of action, you commit a heinous action, that should be addressed. In another forum, and indeed our government officials have raised this, Freedom House has raised it, and indeed the issues that Stephen raises ought to be raised. But in this context, it's almost like saying, well, sure we did this, but on the other hand you're doing X. That's one. Number two, I think that if Stephen spends some time doing a little bit more reading, looking at the internet, looking at articles that have come out, the so-called moderate Muslim leadership has indeed addressed issues of violence and extremism. That doesn't excuse violence and extremism, but the reality of it is you can't keep coming back and saying somehow to the people who aren't doing it, you're responsible for what's going out there. There are many Muslims who are jumping forward. It's a little bit like, and let me just warn your listenership that my analogies are terrible. I've talked for about 35 years.
All right, duly warned.
It doesn't work for them; they can dismiss it. It's a little bit like turning around and saying to the vast majority of Roman Catholics in a situation, you're responsible somehow for the acts of pedophilia that have been committed by some Roman Catholic priests and others.
Oh boy, metaphors get hard in a hurry. They get very complicated,
well,
don't they?
Well, I mean, the reality of it is that, you know, part of the problem we have here is, as the president has said consistently, we need to distinguish between the religion of Islam and the vast majority of Muslims and the extremists. And we need to go after the extremists, we need to denounce the extremists, and we need certainly to hold as responsible Muslim rulers, Muslim religious leaders who don't do that. But I think that when we face an incident like the one that's just occurred, if we don't face that incident head on, why did it happen?
Mm.
What are the political reasons that created a climate where it can happen?
And again, I have to say the allegation of it happening, which has now been retracted.
Exactly. But unless we face that head on, because if we don't face it head on, we're not going to realize that, wait a minute, but why is this reaction? Yes, it's a religious reaction because this is the equivalent, let's say, to a Roman Catholic of desecrating the Eucharist, but it also occurs within a political climate which raises questions about whether or not this is a believable action. That is a climate in which you've had other detainees that have made this claim,
right,
in which the European press has reported on this, in which the Pentagon has not denied that this has occurred. It has not come out and said, we've investigated these previous...
Well, they've come close. It's a nuanced thing they're saying today. No investigations turned this up. They found no credible claims. But you're saying this is not the time to be turning around to the Muslim world and criticizing, though there may be time for that. Stephen, thanks very much for your call. Let me get another caller here. Dan is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I understand that Newsweek had actually taken the initiative to contact the Pentagon so that it would have an opportunity to vet the article.
They ran it by the Pentagon and got no objection, I guess, was the...
Well, it sounds as though some changes were requested and were made, but for a period of 10 days, the Pentagon suggested no concern or complaint with the sentence that's now so infamous. And it strikes me as exceptionally odd that the Pentagon can retrospectively vilify Newsweek in that light, particularly in, as you've described, this context, the context of our present world, where gross abuses by our military have been confirmed, where Bush himself has facilitated abuse by, for example, expanding the authority of the CIA to render now over 100 suspects to foreign countries that are known to practice torture.
So what's the responsibility of the Pentagon in this loop and the backdrop there again? Dan, thank you for your call. James Bettinger, what about it? First of all, what about the sequence here? Newsweek says we ran this by the Pentagon. They didn't object to it. And secondly, I guess the sort of tone behind this is there a larger chilling effect that may go to the American press not reporting on things that maybe it should to keep things from getting out of control?
Yeah, let me ask you to answer the second part first, because I think that is a very real danger. I think that the bar has been raised on reporting any subsequent stories about abuse of the Quran. That it seems to me that the likelihood of a serious unattributed anonymous source story on that is very small. The sequence, as Newsweek reports it, is that it had the item, it showed it to someone in the Pentagon, another unnamed source, two unnamed sources.
Right.
One of the sources said, no, there's something wrong about, I think it's Jeffrey Miller, the commanding general. His role is not included in this. But it turns out that the particular the official they went to, at least according to Newsweek, didn't really know about the substance of whether or not the Quran abuse allegations were in the Southern Command report. So it was a case of the person they'd gone to for vetting not being familiar with the report that he was supposedly looking at.
And a whole lot of trouble flowing from that. James Bettinger at Stanford University, the John S. Knight Fellowship, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Jack, you can hear the whole range here. I mean, dismay and anger with Newsweek over how this could happen. At the same time, this huge background of offenses that have been committed on many fronts already, and the suspicion that there may, in fact, be something true here that just hasn't come out, maybe a chilling effect going forward.
There could well be, but, you know, to the question, how could this happen? That defense advisory report I mentioned really gets to that question. They say, finally, Muslims see America as strangely narcissistic, namely that this war is all about us, for Americans, really no more than an extension of American domestic politics. That's how the Muslim world sees our war on terror. And that narcissism is, it seems to me, just precisely the cultural narcissism that could lead people casually to publish this. That seems to me the precisely right word.
A kind of desensitization or narcissism, in their word, right there. John Esposito, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the Newsweek disaster, the Quran debacle, and America's big, troubled conversation with the Muslim world. How are you interpreting the Newsweek? What story, retraction, calamity? And is the White House too quick to hang all the Muslim anger around Newsweek's neck? Was Newsweek just irredeemably wrong here, or was it misled? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Newsweek disaster, the Quran debacle, and America's big conversation with the Muslim world. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by John Esposito, professor of international affairs and Islamic studies at Georgetown University. Jack Beatty is with us. And right now from New York, we're joined by Shibli Talhami, Anwar Sadat professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland, author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East. Shibli Talhami, thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, my pleasure to be with you.
So what do you make of this? Newsweek says we got it wrong, but even before it can get the retraction out, the Muslim world is up in arms. Why so fast? Why so ready to believe one line in a Newsweek story?
Yeah, well, that's really the question. Obviously, there is a predisposition to believe it for a variety of reasons. The mistrust in the U.S. is very high. There have been many real reports that we know are legitimate, such as the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. People do believe that this is American policy in prisons toward Arabs and Muslims. And I think that's the reality that we have to contend with, because I think over the past few months, there's been a rosy picture painted of a real transformation because of the advocacy of democracy. I think in reality, very little has changed. And when you look at the reality in Arab and Muslim countries today, the anger remains very high. And in my own public opinion surveys over the past year, it is clear that I have identified a rise in Islamic nationalism. More people identify themselves as Muslims than Arabs in the Arab world. And most of that is juxtaposed against the perception that the U.S. is out there to get the Muslim world. This is one of the perception of American intentions in the Middle East. I think we have to come to grips with it. I don't think we have.
But how does the United States, Shibli Talhami, fight self-described holy warriors and not offend Islam?
Well, sure. I think some of those people who are the Al-Qaeda types, they're hopeless. You've got to fight them. I mean, there's no other way around it. You can't win them over. But I think the real question isn't those people. The real question is the vast majority of Arabs and Muslims who really just want ordinary lives, who have Islamic identity or Arab identity or nationalist identity, and who, in fact, could be swayed one way or the other. And those are the people you have to win over. And at the moment, those people simply cannot be won over unless we reassess. Certainly, there is much their governments can do. There is much their societies can do. But frankly, we haven't been asking real questions about our own policies and why it is that people are suspicious when we say we don't do this kind of thing in prison. I think France has not opened our prisons enough to human rights organizations. We've in Guantanamo, there are many reasons why we've been criticized by our own human rights groups on our policies. We've really wanted to put ourselves pretty much outside the norm of international human rights organizations on this one. And that's one reason why you have suspicion. Transparency is better. I think if we put ourselves, under more international scrutiny, accept that, I think it's better. People will have more confidence in what we're doing there. And clearly, Abu Ghraib has done far more damage than we're willing to accept. These images that came out of that prison are really itched on people's minds. It's very hard to change.
Shibli Talhami, stand by there. I want to take a call. Mirna's calling from Boston. Hi, Mirna, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Good evening, rather. I just wanted to make a comment that as
yes.
a moderate, very moderate Muslim, that I was, when I first heard about this situation, that I was very, very upset. And I think that the earlier a caller earlier had made some comparisons to the anger in the Muslim world to flag burning, and I just feel like, you know, moderate Muslims are not the ones who are burning churches and who are killing people and who are, you know, these are the extremists who are doing these type of things. And to sort of put the U.S. government to that level, it makes those of us who are very moderate and very open-minded, you know, very resentful to these type of allegations. We feel like, okay, maybe the United States of America does not seem to understand that there's 1.1 billion Muslims out there and desecration of the Quran is a big deal. So I'm not quite sure what the shock is. It offends everybody.
And as a moderate, you're offended, and don't equate the desecration of Quran's holy book with, you're saying, with flag burning.
Flag burning. I mean, you know, you're talking about, I was horrified when the Afghans, you know, when the Taliban, rather, blew up those beautiful Buddhist churches. I mean, you don't find Muslim moderates disrespecting other religions in
right.
that sense. When the Pope died, everybody was there.
Mirna, let me ask you, if I may, now Newsweek has retracted the story. They said, sorry, we got this wrong. We can't go with this. Do you believe the retraction?
I don't believe the retraction because of the way it was done. I think there was, you know, the delay, the type of weirdness all around it sort of made a lot of people think, you know, hey, you know, all is possible, and since we're in the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib situation, all is possible, and, you know, it's very feasible that soldiers could have done this.
Mirna, we've got it. You're speaking to it just as Shibli Tilhami kind of predicts here, and thank you for calling. John Esposito, what can the United States do to turn around this perception that anything is possible, as Mirna puts it, any desecration?
Well, I think that it certainly has been useful to have senior government officials quickly step out front and make statements, but the fact is their credibility, obviously, is not all that strong. So a real question is going to be, do we wind up walking the way we talk? And what that really means is, for example, doing a much better job at looking into the Guantanamo situation, the Abu Ghraib situation, doing a much better job at looking into concerns about the extent to which things like the Patriot Act and the Secret Evidence Act don't simply target extremists, but wind up really affecting an awful lot of innocent, moderate Muslims. I think that that's going to be a real issue, and a major issue is exactly what somebody mentioned a bit earlier. The fact that we even have the Defense Advisory Board pointing out that the whole public diplomacy program, despite good intentions, has been a failure. And so this new attempt to reboot it, as it were, is going to take an awful lot of effort and prescience to make it work. And it's going to be not only about public relations, but the U.S. is going to also have to look at how is it pursuing its foreign policies.
It's pretty difficult to compete.
Foreign policies in a way that give the impression that its foreign policies are simply geared to redrawing the Middle East or the Muslim world the way the U.S. wants it, or are we really supporting things like democratization and human rights?
And, of course, many critics in the Middle East who would like to portray it as a strategy of dominance there. Let's get another call. Jessica's calling from New York City. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I actually just wanted to call because I'm extremely frustrated and upset by the, you know, the Newsweek retraction.
From what angle? Why exactly, Jessica?
Well, no, I'm frustrated because you have to ask, given you know, the position of the United States and Abu Ghraib, and, you know, all obviously the tremendous amount of conflict happening, and the United States coming, you know, basically coming forth and saying to Newsweek, you have to retract the story because it's very damaging to our image.
Well, and because they said it's not true.
They said it's not true. However, it still seems to me that there are some, you know, other implications that doesn't speak to me to say that is definitely not true.
You're not so sure about that. Jessica, let us pick that up, and thank you very much for your call. Shibli Tilhami, here's a picture where you're saying in the Muslim street people aren't going to believe the retraction. Here's Jessica, an American, not believing the retraction.
Well, that's what I'm saying is I think if you take a survey among the American public opinion right now and ask the question, do you believe that this sort of thing is possible in American prisons toward people who are from the Middle East are being killed, And I think that you would be surprised probably to find that a large majority of Americans believe that it's possible, whether or not the facts of this story are right. And also, if you look at the retraction, it was a retraction of a particular fact about this issue not being in an apparent Pentagon report, rather than a complete retraction of the possibility it could have taken place. So I think that's why people are suspicious. And here I want to say, you know, obviously if you look at the reporting over the past couple of days, it's focused on the media. Certainly that's an important issue. I think the media responsibility is great, and people have to be careful. But I don't think it's the media's job to worry about consequences. I think they have to worry about getting it right, absolutely. And when they don't, they have to be blamed. But they cannot possibly worry about the consequences. It's the events that generate the consequence, not the reporting of the event. And I, as a citizen, I want my to tell me the truth. I want to know. I don't want them to make a judgment that I cannot handle it.
But when they're wrong and you've got consequences, it becomes even trickier. Shibley Tilhami, your line's breaking up there, but we know you're in the middle of JFK Airport, but we're very grateful for you to join us tonight. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
John Esposito, I want to put it to you here. When we look at the response from the Islamic world, is it, and I hate to say this, but is it possible the U.S. is sliding, whether it likes to or not, whether it wants to or not, into this kind of crusader role in this conflict?
I think that the risk is that it's clear that the U.S. it has slid into certainly the perception of the crusader role. I mean, that's been there for a long time. But the fact is, I give you a quick story. After 9/11, on 9/12, I had an email from a friend in Cairo. And she said to me, "This is terrible what's happened. Your country will certainly want to go after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. But we wonder whether this is the beginning or the end." And when I queried her on what she meant, she came back and said, "Will this become an excuse for the U.S. to engage in a more expansive policy to redraw the map of the Middle East to meet or fit its interests?" And I think that remains the challenge of the administration, to demonstrate that that is not the case. And that's going to mean not only looking at our policies, but making sure that we operate in a way in which the Bush administration did not operate in its first term, but a way in which it's trying to emphasize now in a much more multilateral way, partnering both with Europe and with Arab and Muslim allies. Unless we put a real focus on the way in which we pursue our policies, then even good intentions like promoting democracy will be seen by others as, wait a minute, is it really promoting democracy, or are you going to use the promotion of democracy as an excuse to topple or oppress regimes that you don't like while you look the other way when and create somebody like Karimov in Uzbekistan, if you read the recent headlines?
Right. With that, John Esposito, we've got to say goodbye tonight. We thank you for joining us. John Esposito of Georgetown University. Jack Beatty, there it is, an unevent, and all this swirling around it. It makes me think of that jar in Tennessee.
But, you know, you have to wonder about the signal we could have sent the Muslim world after Abu Ghraib. If Mr. Rumsfeld, General Boykin, the Christian fundamentalist running the war on terror, General Myers, had all been cashiered. This is how serious we take this, folks. We didn't do it.
Well, the word tonight is we didn't do this, that it wasn't flushed. We'll see how it all unfolds. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, making sense of the violence in Uzbekistan. This is On Point. On Friday, armed citizens stormed a local prison in the Fergana Valley in eastern Uzbekistan. Their goal, to free 23 inmates charged with Islamic extremism. An additional 2,000 men escaped, and a massive anti-government demonstration erupted. Security forces fired into the crowd, killing, reportedly, hundreds of protesters, according to human rights groups. President Karimov said he stopped a dangerous rebellion. Britain and Russia called it a brutal government crackdown. Uzbekistan has been a prized U.S. ally in the war on terror. This latest eruption and bloody crackdown puts new pressure on the United States to reevaluate its strong ties to Uzbekistan. Allison Gill, a researcher for Human Rights Watch who was based in Tashkent for the past 2 years, joins me now to look at this past week's news. Allison Gill, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So how are you interpreting, or how are you hearing the different interpretations of what's happened in Uzbekistan?
Well, The U.S. interpretation falls, I think, sadly short of where it should be, and the U.K. comes a lot closer to what I think the reality is. What happened, it seems, from all reports, and we'll have our own independent reporting soon, I hope, is that President Karimov ordered troops to fire on protesters who are largely peaceful and unarmed protesters with grievances against his government. And the U.S. is falling once again for the convenient response that this has something to do with terrorism when it does not.
Condoleezza Rice has said just in the last day that Uzbekistan needs to move toward more open government. Is that the kind of critique that's justified at a moment like this?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think the U.S. needs to go even further.
I mean, it sounded stern, but mild in a way.
It's mild and it's too little too late. I mean, the U.S. has been calling Karimov and Uzbekistan a good friend and ally and a close partner in the war on terror for some time now, for years, when, in fact, President Karimov has used counterterrorism and U.S. support as a justification for massive abuses at home.
Remind us of the human rights kind of abuses, that the record that you see here in advance of the rebellion, the eruption last week.
The abuses in advance of the rebellion?
In Uzbekistan, what are some of the abuses that you've seen, that you've recounted?
Torture is systematic in the criminal justice system. So prisoners are tortured or are at serious risk of torture from the moment of arrest throughout their imprisonment. Religious beliefs are very tightly controlled by the state, and anyone whose peaceful practice or beliefs falls outside of heavy state regulation or control is subject to arbitrary arrest, unfair trial, and long prison terms. There are no political parties that are legal. They're all banned. There are tight controls on civic participation and NGOs, non-governmental organizations. There are no free media. I mean, it's a very, very closed society.
And the outbreak of protest last week, a protest by Islamic fundamentalists or something else?
No, something else. The men that were accused of Islamic fundamentalism are businessmen who may or may not have some affiliation with a very small local Islamic group that really just tells Muslims to live according to Islamic principles. It's a non-political group. There's no record of violence. And the men that were on trial supported hundreds and hundreds of families throughout the region economically because they employed them in their many businesses and factories. So it was really a convergence of economic hardship and poverty combined with arbitrary policing and abusive government kind of coming together and outpouring onto the streets.
Allison Gill, an American Air Force base 90 miles from the Afghan border in Uzbekistan. Do you expect the kind of pressure from Washington in the aftermath of this uprising and bloody quelling that might change the way Karimov does business?
Well, I certainly hope that of the United States, but the record, the U.S. record on pressuring Uzbekistan and human rights isn't perfect. I don't think our base, the American base, is in jeopardy because even if the U.S. comes down a lot harder on Karimov, Karimov wants the base, I think, as much as more than the Americans do. So he's not going to walk away from the relationship.
Allison Gill, with that, we're out of time tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Allison Gill, a researcher for Human Rights Watch. She was based in Tashkent in Uzbekistan for the past 2 years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University.